I'm Susie Welch, the host of Becoming You, a podcast where I help you stop living by default and start living by design. Listen to Becoming You wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Lauren Berry, and this is On Deadline, where you get a closer look at a story from Odyssey's radio newsrooms across the country. We're midway through 2025, and the economy is either booming or busting, depending on which factors you consider. So we thought it would be a perfect time to take an unbiased look at the key indicators driving the U.S. economy. Today, we're delivering the latest news on inflation, the housing market, prices, and the retail landscape. We're going to kick things off with the latest news on inflation from WCCO Radio in Minneapolis.
I'm Deborah Rodriguez. U.S. inflation has just hit its highest level since February.
We are seeing the impact of tariffs starting to push up the inflation rate.
CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger on the Labor Department's just released report showing consumer prices rose 2.7% in June from a year ago. That compares to an annual increase of 2.4% in May.
We see it most specifically in the food part of this survey. Coffee prices up by 2.2% in just 1 month. Citrus prices up 2.3%.
Those increases are also expected to underscore the Federal Reserve's reluctance to cut short-term interest rates.
Here's more on what to expect in the world of inflation for the rest of 2025 with Tommy Tucker at WWL Radio in New Orleans.
To get us going, Patrick Penfield joins us, our friend, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University, talking about inflation, tariffs. It's still wondering about tariffs and Liberation Day and the effect that's had on anything. I checked my 401k earlier just to see how it was doing. I hadn't checked it in a long time, and apparently it's doing okay. I took some money out earlier because I wanted to make sure I had enough to pay off the house just in case everything tanked. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. I don't know. Either way, I got peace of mind. Tell me about inflation, the effect on the economy, the stock market, everything else. I don't know how you measure all of this, Patrick, because there's a lot of stuff that goes into it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Tommy, you know, with inflation, it's, you know, again, overall increase in prices. So we're, you know, overall, it's not bad. It's about 2.4% year to date. The Fed looks for it about 2%. So inflation right now is okay, right? I think it's bearable. You know, the big issue is what's going to happen in the second half of 2025. And that's, I think, when we'll start to see some of the tariff impacts.
So, again, going back to tariffs, I don't quite know what the president's doing. I know he's probably negotiating. He talked about Liberation Day, then he talked about not imposing tariffs, and then he talked about countries coming to the table, but I don't know who's coming to the table, who's not. He sent a letter, apparently letters to people. I don't know what's going on there, but has anything changed with tariffs? Have we imposed tariffs on anything? And have those prices or have those tariffs begun to reflect themselves on prices that we pay yet?
So, yes, tariffs have been, you know, basically put in on a lot of countries. And, you know, we're seeing that just with the amount of revenue that Customs Borders is collecting, right? So they're collecting billions of dollars. So, you know, somebody's paying for that. So what, Tommy, I work with a lot of purchasing individuals, and, you know, this is one thing, it's a lot of angst. So if you're in purchasing right now, you're kind of stressed about what to do. And, you know, purchasing people are very clever, right? So they're figuring out ways to kind of get around the tariffs or try to minimize its impact to business. So that's one of the reasons why we haven't seen its impact yet. A lot of it is due to companies pulling in inventory, you know, in the first and second quarter, you know, before the tariffs hit. And now, you know, now we're starting to see, you know, companies starting to struggle with tariffs. And I think that, for the most part, is really what's going on in the United States. The big issue, Tommy, is small businesses. And they're the ones that are suffering right now with this uncertainty. They're not sure about, you know, what's going on price-wise. If you're a big company, you have resources that you can dedicate to kind of figure out how to minimize the impact of tariffs. If you're a small company, you're going to struggle. And this is my big concern for the second half of 2025 is, can small businesses survive?
Is that primarily because of cash flow when it comes to small businesses and not having the money to tie up in inventory to beat the tariffs?
Absolutely, Tommy. So again, if you're a small business, you know, you're trying to, you know, minimize your, you know, your expenditures. And again, that's tough. And you're right that this is the big issue. You just don't have the cash to be able to invest in inventory like these big companies do.
So what products are we talking about, Professor, specifically?
You know, the ones I'm concerned about, anything that has steel and aluminum in it, and that's just because of the tariff hikes of like 50%. So I'm very concerned of what we'll see in the second half of 2025, anything that has aluminum, anything that has steel. You know, that's where, you know, I think we'll start to see some of the bigger impacts. And I think, you know, consumers will start to see that in the second half. Some other things, again, apparel, electronics, you know, any type of cars. I think food, if you can food, is my big concern. So, I think the tariff impact is going to happen in the second half. We're going to start to see it in probably, I'd say, end of July, August. That's when, you know, I think consumers will noticeably see that prices have gone up.
Did you say canned food?
Yeah, because, you know, most of the metal that goes into cans is imported. And so, you know, the can manufacturers, they import that that particular aluminum. And then, again, just trying to make the cans, that metal that goes into the cans, is the tariff impact. So we're going to see anywhere from a 10 to 15% increase, you know, on canned goods. So if you have dog food, cat food, you know, anything that you use, you know, cans for, you'll start to see that. Again, you'll see that probably, I would say, in the August time frame.
So not 10 to 15% increase in the price of the can, 10 to 15% in the price of the product because of the increased tariff on the aluminum or the steel or whatever is used in making the can?
That's correct.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, that taught me something I didn't know. Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, that's I think that's a little, we're going to see a lot of things. And, you know, for the most part, consumers are going to be surprised at, you know, some of the things that are going to go up in price.
What are you hearing from the bigger companies like the Walmarts and the Costcos and the Sam's Clubs and these kind of places? What are they doing to get ahead of this, or are they doing anything, or can they?
Oh, yeah, they're doing a lot, Tommy. You know, they've actually have war rooms set up in some of these big companies, and what they do is they sit down and they kind of have these giant spreadsheets, and they look at, you know, what's the latest and greatest tariff that's being impacted today. And that's the unfortunate thing is, mm-hmm. you know, things are changing on a daily basis. So, you know, you have to look and see what's going on. And so a lot of these companies, you know, what they're doing is they're sourcing from other countries when they see, you know, tariff go up. Some are doing what's called tariff reengineering, where they're trying to reduce the actual product itself or change the product itself to get a lower tariff rate, which you can do as long as it's, you know, legal and above board. Some companies are bringing in inventory in these bonded warehouses, and you're allowed to pull it out at these bonded warehouses at whatever the tariff rate is. So, again, I'm a cash flow, right? So you're tying up.
What kind of warehouse did you say?
They're called bonded warehouses. Yeah, bonded warehouses. Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's interesting. So you can place product in a bonded warehouse. You don't get charged a tariff rate until you actually pull it, and then it's whatever the tariff rate is that day, which is very interesting. But the downside
sounds
is
like future, like the future market with tariffs, when somebody's gambling on whether the tariff's going to go up or down. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if you own bonded warehouses, your business has been exploding, and we've kind of seen that on the West Coast. So yeah, I think for the most part, you know, a lot of companies, especially the bigger ones, are just trying to minimize the impact of tariffs as much as they possibly can.
Man, you're teaching me some stuff, Patrick. I love to learn different stuff. So when you say the rate of inflation has calmed down, that's different than price increase due to tariffs, or is the price of tariffs increasing products included in the inflation rate?
Yeah, so that's included in the inflation rate. So right now it's about 2.4% of, you know, that's your core inflation. Excuse me, that's regular inflation. Your core inflation was 2.8%. That would be food and energy. So overall, not bad. I mean, the Fed wants it to be about 2%. I mean, that's their goal. And, you know, that's when they'll start, you know, reducing interest rates. And so when that happens, that's probably when you'll see them get a little more aggressive with trying to do that. But my expectation, Tommy, is probably for the second half, 2025, prices are going to go up. So I'm a little concerned.
Well, I'm just trying to get a handle on when we say inflation rate, that includes tariffs?
Yes, absolutely, Tommy.
So I'm trying to figure out, Professor, where we are with tariffs, what's on, what's off, and the method behind the madness with President Trump. And I'm just wondering, the idea behind tariffs, have they produced any good things for the country, or have they resulted in any net gains, I guess, for the country or the economy or for businesses or whatever they were intended to do?
Yeah, so Tommy, the tariffs overall, they've actually generated about $100 billion worth of revenue for the U.S. government. So that's almost double what we saw last year at this time period. So overall, over $100 billion.
Okay, well, that's money in the Treasury. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so, if you look at the overall impact, so when April hit, that's when all the, the tariffs was going really pretty high overall, right? So it was almost 30% over everything as far as what was coming in the country. Now with President Trump kind of negotiating deals, it's fallen probably, about 15%. So, overall, the impact for tariffs is about 15% on everything that comes into this country. So the goal, again, for the government is to raise revenue, and that's really what tariffs are. They're a tax, and so, they're taxing somebody. Somebody is paying for that stuff to come in. So small businesses, large businesses, whatever you import, you're paying a tax on what you're buying from other countries.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
So the tariffs can either result in revenue for the U.S. Treasury, which they have $100 billion, or the president wants to bring manufacturing back to this country, right?
Yeah, that's really what should prompt it. So what happens is, like, the buyers that I work with, what they'll do is if they see, this increase in tariffs from other countries, they'll try to source domestically if they can. The unfortunate thing, Tommy, is, some of the stuff you can't get, here in the United States, like coffee and avocados and things that only can be grown or made in certain countries. And so that's what a lot of the buyers are kind of struggling with is trying to, again, minimize impacts and trying to find domestic sources if you can. And so if we can find it here in the United States, that's great. But if you can't, you're kind of out of luck.
So who paid the $100 billion? Where'd that come from?
Great question, Tommy. So somebody paid for it. So it's usually the companies that import those products in. So they, in turn, have to figure out what to do. So they have paid for it. So they normally what they'll do is they'll probably pass it along to the consumer. And that's just because they have to make a profit.
So when it comes to countries that have come to get a better deal from the United States, who has responded to that or what have the tariffs produced as far as that goes?
Yeah, as far as I'm aware of, the UK was one. So there was not a trade deal, but I guess just a kind of an understanding of what the agreement is. And I think there was one other country, and I'm trying to remember who that might be. But from what I gather right now, all I can think of is the UK that actually has somewhat of a deal with the United States. And so there's a lot of ongoing stuff. Yeah, I'm sorry, Tommy.
When it comes to the president instituting them, pausing them, is there a method to the madness here? Is that part of some kind of negotiating ploy, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely, Tommy. So it's about position of power, right? So he's, again, trying to more or less force these countries to accept whatever terms the United States is giving them. And so that's why he's sending out the letters versus trying to enact some type of trade agreement. Trade agreements take years. What the president's doing is just trying to unilaterally enact, a price increase. And that's what's going on these days.
And you say you think prices are going to go up in the next 6 months?
Absolutely, yeah. Because, basically these companies, they're paying this tariff. So, again, they're not going to absorb it because they've got to make money. So what will happen is that consumers will start to see prices go up in the second half of 2025.
Now, what's going on in the world of housing? Here's the Noon Business Hour at WBBM News Radio in Chicago discussing whether it's a buyer's market or a seller's market.
I'm Rachel Pearson, filling in for Rob Hart today. Home builders are slashing prices at the fastest rate in 3 years. As economic concerns continue to weigh on demand, raising the big question, will things finally improve for home buyers? Drew Wishover, founder and owner of Inspired Title Group here in Chicago. Drew, glad to have you with us. I'm curious, pick your brain here, because builder confidence is still in negative territory despite that slight uptick we saw this month. But what's behind, we'll call it, the ongoing pessimism in the housing sector?
Yeah, that's a great question, Rachel, and thanks for having me out here today. There's a lot of things going on in this market that has just been, really kind of perplexing right now. The builder confidence is really down, and it's just saying that, hey, there's going to be modest improvements in these starts in these coming years, but the Chicago real estate market, especially for new construction, I mean, it's rebounded in this first quarter pretty strong. So the momentum is setting a positive tone for the rest of the year. So hopefully that is starting to encourage and excite some of these buyers and give them some confidence that there's going to be a shift in the market.
Yeah. So is this purely momentum that's driving this trend, sort of making it a little bit more palatable for potential buyers? Or are there other factors at play too?
I think there's a few factors. I mean, I think the excitability of that is that, you know, the buyers are you know, making some moves. They've got these life changes maybe that are happening. They've got family growth. Maybe they want to downsize and it's time to kind of, you know, re-enter the market. So that's going to force, you know, more of the buyers into this marketplace. And then you've got the other side of this where the buyers today, they want more of these turnkey, already done options. So going into the builders and getting that house that's already completed, they don't have to do any work on it. So I think that's also exciting the market a little bit as well, because the pricing and things have kind of, you know, maintained a reasonable level right now.
Well, and builders are also buying down mortgage rates. That's a strategy compared to just, say, flat out price cuts in terms of effectiveness. Do you think that's going to have an impact on profits for builders?
Of course it will, but I think it's also it's a volume, it's a numbers game for them. I mean, they've got the luxury of having, you know, the mortgage companies that are backed with them, and then they've got realtors that they work with, so they're able to offer these tremendous discounts because, I mean, there is some decent markup in the game of, you know, home building, but they can still fluctuate and buy down some of these mortgages to make it attractive for folks to come out and look at their homes, buy into it, get into their home turnkey, not have to worry about having a mortgage rate that's 6 or 7%. It can be potentially less because they're probably going to make it up on the back end of that construction cost and keeping those things down.
So, Drew, what's one thing that you're going to be watching for to see sort of if the housing market starts to stabilize in the second half of this year?
I want to see if the inventory is really going to start to increase. I want to see if the sellers are going to come off of the fence and start putting their houses up for sale to kind of keep down the pricing of the, you know, the rising house prices and kind of get that back to some kind of a norm where people aren't overpaying or overbidding for these houses and they're not meeting appraisal values and things. I think that'll really stabilize and help the whole condition of what our market's doing.
Dallas-Fort Worth is another one of those regions that's booming. But is it actually a good place to buy? Take a listen to KRLD Radio discussing just that topic.
History That Doesn't Suck is a legit, hard-hitting American history podcast told through entertaining stories. As we approach America's 250th anniversary, now might be the time to go back and learn how we got here. With more than 200 episodes, you can binge your way, decade by decade, defining event to defining event, from the founding into the 20th century. Join me, Professor Greg Jackson, for History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
With mortgage rates still hovering near 7% and rent prices cooling in some Dallas neighborhoods, many first-time home buyers are asking, is it smarter to rent or to buy right now? On today's Ask the Expert, real estate expert Cliff Freeman joins us here in the KRLD Zoom room. Cliff, that question, is it better to rent or to buy? That question is very popular right now. What would be your take on it?
That's the $64,000 question. And, you know, if you read and you haven't been asleep the last few months, you've probably noticed that a lot of the media are saying that it's cheaper to rent right now than it is to buy. And so there are cases for that. But at the end of the day, I would really say it depends more on what your long-term strategy is. And if you realize that people who own real estate typically have as much as $400,000 more in net worth as those who rent, you got to kind of take a lot of things into consideration. But renting could be a great option for you today.
One thing that I've seen in a study that came out this week talked about the fact that around 40% of home buyers say they regret buying that home because they underestimated the actual cost, because they're just looking at what the mortgage rate is and what their monthly payment would be.
Yeah, great point, especially first-time home buyers. And, you know, that's why I love seeing first-time home buyers buy new construction, because it's like bumper-to-bumper warranty. And the maintenance on those homes is really minimal. It's a really great thing for people, and especially those who are, you know, where you're working a lot, you don't have time, you don't have the money, and you just don't have the worry. Where we get into issues, and by the way, builders right now are offering great incentives. That's part of what is creating some headwinds for people who own homes, putting them on the market. They're competing against new construction, and these builders are just, you know, pounding the low rates and, you know, the design center credits and all this sort of thing, trying to move their inventory. And they do have that price elasticity, that sort of flexibility to be able to deliver a lower price product right now than the resale market. You know, these other sellers, like people like us that own a home, we still got that mentality that we've built over the last 5 years that, oh no, prices will never go down, and which is quite the contrary. We've actually seen prices retreat year over year here recently, and that's something that tends to a point of inflection.
With Rankin's point, maybe from a lifestyle perspective, how should someone decide if they're better off renting or buying right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. Obviously, we just mentioned that home ownership can have maintenance issues. Typically, rentals don't. You've got the landlord taking care of things. If your sink leaks, you make a phone call, boom, their person is there to take care of it. The other thing is, you know, there are some really great lifestyle rental communities with great pools, great clubhouses, a lot of, you know, scene for younger people who want to congregate, get to know their neighbors and hang out on the weekends, that sort of thing. So lifestyle does play a lot into it. Apartments aren't for everybody, but for some people, that lifestyle would really suit where they are career-wise and in their life.
But what about the concept of renting homes? Is that still a thing in North Texas?
Well, David, in fact, it's got to be, you know, a question that a lot of sellers are asking themselves right now is, hey, if I can't get what I want for my home, I'm just going to take it off the market. Should I rent it? What should I do? And in fact, we are seeing a lot more single families right now convert from being primary residences to becoming rental properties because sellers just want to wait it out. They're not content with where the market is right now, but they do believe that going forward, we're going to have some positive things here happen in the Dallas area.
I've heard of a lot of trending or this trend among some of my colleagues and friends where, you know, the lifestyle of owning a home and living in a subdivision is not quite what they're looking for. They want that community, as you mentioned. So they're buying these, you know, these new townhomes or these brand new homes, and then they're just putting them up for Airbnb. And then they're still living, you know, the apartment high rise lifestyle, and they're just, you know, making rent off of renting. How much has the culture changed for because of Airbnbs and Vrbo's and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, this the younger generation right now loves mobility. They love not being tied down. And a lot of them believe that if they purchase a home, God, I'll be stuck in that for 5 years, 7 years, 9 years. And it reminds them of their parents, right? And sort of growing up in that house, it seemed like their whole life. And so they would prefer to be able to say, hey, if I get tired of Dallas, I don't want to be tied down to a house here. If I want to move to New York and go there and see if I can find a job there, I want to be able to make that call without having the burden of you know, getting a home sold, you know, and all that thing. So for a young, upwardly mobile person, it might be a good idea to, you know, to look at short-term solutions for housing rather than, you know, making that commitment, because homeownership is a commitment. It's the American dream, and it's something that I wish everybody would be able to experience because it is a wealth creation vehicle. But on the other hand, you've got to be in the right place in your life and in your career. It's kind of like the decision to have kids, right? That's a long-term decision. It's not a short-term decision, as we all know. And buying a house is sort of that same thing.
Yeah, and there are people that will want to actually set down roots in a place, especially for those first-time homebuyers, that they're looking to stay in a place for a while, but they don't necessarily know all the extra added expenses like HOA fees and the fact that they think that their mortgage is going to be the same every single year if they have a fixed rate, but other things can increase it.
One of the biggest caveats, David, is with new home construction. If you buy a new home, that appraised value, if the first occurred and that was a vacant lot and they built the house in that year, then your taxes at the county are going to be taxed based on that lot value. And a lot of first-time home buyers, the ones that have gotten in trouble recently that have highly leveraged loans with very little down payment, and they're maxed out, all of a sudden they see their escrow payments go up from a few hundred dollars to several hundred, even $1,000 a month because of an escrow shortage. And that happened because they didn't get the counseling from either their lender or their realtor or the new home salesperson that their taxes would increase substantially when the county came back the next year and appraised that home for full value. So, in fact, a lot of the foreclosures that we're seeing right now are exactly happening because of those reasons.
For someone who's thinking about renting or buying, let's just talk about the financial costs right now. What's like the median price for renting here in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex?
Oh, we're looking, you know, in the neighborhood of $2,400. There's a range depending on where you live, but say $1,400 to $2,800. Just ballpark, and you get into some other areas like Frisco Prosper. If you're doing single family, obviously you're going to be paying more. But if you compare that to the average home price in Dallas, which is about $449 through I guess June of this year, and you compare the cost all in on that home, if you're putting down like on an FHA loan and you've got, you know, your principal, interest, taxes, insurance, not just homeowners insurance, but you've got mortgage insurance premiums and monthly premiums on FHA, you know, you're looking almost just south of $4 a month versus that, you know, rental average of about $2,400. Now, do you get taxes? There are other things that come into consideration. You have to look at the after-tax benefit. But at the end of the day, if we're talking cash flow and people who are living paycheck to paycheck, that makes a huge difference in terms of having to put that money out today and then hopefully getting it back in a refund at the end of the year.
Are we at a level where the balloon could burst at any point and home prices could actually start to drop, especially in the Dallas-Fort Worth area? Is this area just too hot for people moving in?
Well, compared to other parts of the country, David, I think, you know, we're still in good shape. There's a lot of equity in homes here. This is not a case of the sky is going to be falling or anything like that. It's completely different from 2008. There are no systemic issues right now in the mortgage market or in the home market. We just had a fast run up over the last 5 years because of the increase, the influx of people. We had 5,000 people a week moving here a couple of years ago. Now we've got about 90,000 a year. So there's still a good flow of people coming in. The builders are catching up. But, you know, could we see a pullback, a modest pullback in prices? We're starting to see a little bit of that now. That was the inflection point I was referring to. House prices are down a bit year over year, but it's not compared to the falling nine things that we saw in 2008, 2009 and those days.
Cliff, anything else you want our listeners to know?
The only thing I can say is, look, folks, you know, the only way you can make money in real estate is to own it. If you're renting, you're only making your landlord money. So when you find the time is right and you find that perfect house at the perfect price, go ahead and do it. You will not regret it later on. But please, please, please make sure you get great advice. Find good, competent, qualified people to help you along the way. Just like we don't encourage your own kidney transplant, we don't encourage you to go out on your own and try to buy your, especially your first house if you haven't done it before. So good luck, happy house shopping, and it's going to be, things will be great. We're all going to be fine, and real estate is a great way for people to create wealth. So don't ignore it. Go ahead and just take the jump.
Credit card debt is another indicator of the economic health of American households, and there is a worrying trend along those lines. People paying for vacations with debt. Here's more on that from Tommy Tucker at WWL Radio in New Orleans.
couple of different things when it comes to vacation. Would you take a vacation on credit? Have you ever borrowed money to take a vacation? That just goes against everything I was ever raised to do, so I would never do that. The other question is, have you ever taken a vacation that's come in on budget? I can say I never have. It always seems to run over budget, and then you face the credit card when you come back. Ted Rossman joins us now, Bankrate Senior Industry Analyst, to tell us what Americans look like on vacation. How you doing, Ted?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Have you ever taken a, I'm not trying to pry into your personal life, but I can't imagine you borrowing money to go on vacation.
No, I've been fortunate enough to always be able to pay credit cards in full, which obviously is the more desirable part if you can. I understand, you know, nobody really wants to be in credit card debt, but certainly if you can use cards to your advantage by paying in full, avoiding interest, getting those rewards, that's the better way to go if you can.
Of course, if you can pay it, yeah, every 30 days, that's different than, or if you can pay it the total and use the points, that's different than actually financing a vacation on a credit card, which, when it comes to any kind of long-term debt, you never want to finance on a credit card, right? I mean, right there, that should throw up a warning sign.
That's right. Yeah, we want to avoid adding to debt, certainly for discretionary reasons. I mean, I understand sometimes people need to do it for daily essentials or one-off emergency expenses. Those are actually the biggest causes of credit card debt. But yeah, it would be worrisome to put a vacation on a card and pay a 20% interest rate for years and years. That's the issue, is that half of credit card holders already carry debt from month to month, and the average interest rate's about 20%, and you know, the average debt load is about $6,600, according to TransUnion. So, you know, if you make minimum payments in that scenario, you're in debt for 18 years, and you pay $9,600 in interest. We just don't want to add to that if we can. I feel like a better choice would be to maybe scale back the vacation plan. Not that you can't have any fun, but you know, maybe you stick a little closer to home, or try to set money aside in advance. That's another good tip, is that research shows that when you name an account, it's powerful. Mm-hmm. You're less likely to raid the account for something else. You're more likely to want to contribute to it. Like if there's a trip you really want to go on next year, name the account Paris 2026 or whatever it is, and then you're going to steadily contribute to it. You're less likely to dip into it for something else. That can actually be a powerful motivator.
I guess the way I was raised, Ted, if a vacation is supposed to be to relax, I'm not relaxing if I know I'm taking out a loan from a bank or financing the vacation, or that I got to pay for it when I come back. Although, as I said, a lot of times it always runs over budget because you figure I'm here. How often am I going to be in England? How often am I going to be here, there, the other thing? You get the souvenirs, you have the experience, whatever. How important is it when it comes to taking a vacation that you establish a budget, and does that go to planning what you're going to do before?
It's a really good idea, because then you're accounting for it on the front end, and then it's not an impulse buy. It's not something, hopefully, that's going to lead to overspending. Sticking to a budget is definitely important. We see in our research that about a third of summer travelers are going to take on debt, which is worrisome just given how high these interest rates are. It's about 20% on average for credit cards. We're actually seeing an uptick in the percentage of people using buy now, pay later services like Affirm and Afterpay and Klarna for vacations and other discretionary purchases. There's even a buy now, pay later company specifically geared towards travel called Uplift. And I know the installments sound tempting, but it's still debt and it can still stick with you. Some of the appeal is that maybe it's shorter term or a lower interest than a credit card, but not always. These plans are evolving, and many of them are lasting longer, and they are charging higher interest rates. We see in our data that only about half of Americans plan to travel this summer, 46% of U.S. adults. About a quarter are not planning any sort of summer vacation. About a quarter are not sure yet. 10% planning a staycation. These figures are actually pretty similar to last year, very similar, which is kind of surprising. You would think that this year we might have seen more of a dip just because people are worried about tariffs and inflation and is there going to be a recession. But travel is kind of holding its own. The demand has plateaued a little bit, but it's plateaued at a high level.
So let me ask you this. I'm old school, right, Ted? You know that. When it comes to buy now, pay later, I can appreciate that from a branding standpoint. from a product differentiation standpoint, from the marketing side of it, but that by definition is credit, and that is when you have credit, you incur debt. So I don't understand how buy now, pay later is different.
Some people kind of trick themselves into the installments, almost like an infomercial of four easy payments of $19.99, and you don't think of it as being debt. One of the interesting trends is
Hang on a second. I don't mean to argue with you, but it's called buy now, pay later. So how can you not think of that as debt? I'm not trying to be silly here. Seriously.
Well, a lot of people do view it differently. You know, these plans started out as more of an e-commerce play for clothing and electronics and other things. And the fixed installments are one of the things that draws people in, because open-ended credit card debt can be scary, can drag on for a really long time. A lot of these users are young people without much money and without much credit. It started out as four interest-free payments over 6 weeks, but it's gravitated oftentimes now to longer plans, anywhere from 3 months to a couple of years. And those plans do tend to charge interest, often similar to a credit card, something like 15 or 20%, sometimes more, sometimes less. But the installments are part of what draws people in. And sometimes we can trick ourselves with that, because you don't think about the total cost. You just think about the biweekly or monthly installments. And these plans are often now being used for services, everything from dining to travel to medical, dental, veterinary, other things. In some ways, it's a smart business model, but it's not always to the consumer's advantage. You do need to be careful about the total cost. A lot of people get fixated on the installments, and they don't view it as debt the same way as you might with a credit card or a student loan or something like that.
We'll take a break. I don't understand how that's different than buying a car and making installment payments on a car. Maybe I'm missing something. I don't know. Ted Rossman's our guest, Bankrate senior industry analyst. I'm old school when it comes to money, man. I got to tell you, I really am. That's the way I was raised. That's the way I'll always be. 621 traffic now, WWL. Well, you did say right here. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Ted Rossman, Bankrate senior industry analyst. Ted, I think one of the things that you said just now that's very important is name an account. Dedicate an account and money and a purpose behind it, like a vacation account or a Paris account, whatever you want to call it, and then you'd be more likely to save and less likely to rate it, correct?
That's right. Yeah, that can be a great tip to save for a vacation or a home renovation or lots of things. I mean, you can often have many sub-accounts within a larger bank account. The main point here is giving every dollar a job, knowing where your money is going, budgeting for things on the front end, both essential and discretionary. It's something that a lot of people are doing with envelopes, with cash. It sounds kind of old school, but even a lot of Gen Zers are doing this. It's kind of a TikTok craze where you get these nice looking envelopes and you have one for gas and one for groceries and one for restaurants, and that's your monthly budget for that category. And because it's cash, when it's out, and you can't go into debt. That's something that a lot of people are using as a debt avoidance technique.
Let me tell you, whatever it takes. I know I was on a roll for a while of just hoarding cash and saving it and turning into $100 bills until I had to get it out of the house. Then when I tried to get it out of the house, the bank wouldn't take it because of IRS regulations. Long story. Somebody texted in and said, leaving Wednesday for Panama City Beach till following Monday, then leaving there for Myrtle Beach for another week, country festival rounds, can I afford it? No, am I going? Hell yeah, need a reset. So along those lines, Ted Rossman, I don't know how old you are, and that's not important, but there is a balance I've found as I matriculate down the road of life between saving and living responsibly, and, you know, the clock continues to tick, and maybe if you wanted to climb Everest and you keep putting it off, by the time you get to be 50, you're not going to make it. So how do you balance bucket list items with living within your means?
Well, that's an interesting question, and sometimes people put fun names on it, like doom spending or revenge spending. These are trends that we're seeing among people, especially in their 20s, some in their 30s as well. The idea is that, unfortunately, a lot of people are pessimistic about the economy. We see that in various consumer sentiment surveys from the University of Michigan and the Conference Board and others. People are not feeling great about the economy. A lot of people are still spending anyway, which is really interesting. Sometimes they're doing it because maybe things are better than they realize. But other times it is sort of out of this pessimism that, you know, I'm worried about my student loans, I'm worried about high housing costs and childcare, and, there's a lot of expensive household formation costs that have only gotten higher, and a lot of young people are pessimistic about these traditional milestones. They're delaying getting married or having kids, but you know, at least they can go on the trip. At least they can go to the music festival or the hot new restaurant. This is a trend that we're seeing, and sometimes people are even taking on debt to do so. Some of it is connected to the pandemic, you only live once kind of sentiment. There's a lot of uncertainty out there, and a lot of people are living for today, and they're going to figure out how to pay for it later.
You know, one thing I wish, and I guess it's human nature, if I was as cheap when I was 20 as I am now, I'd be in pretty good shape. But I guess none of us are, right, Ted?
Well, yeah, I mean, we do need to find that balance. One thing that young people have on their side is time. And every dollar you invest in the markets when you're in your 20s could be $30 or $40 or $50 by the time you retire. So that's one thing I would underscore, is that you don't even necessarily need to put in a ton of money when you're young, because you probably don't have a ton of money. But compounding really works for you. If you get a 10% return, which the markets have historically delivered, well, your money's doubling every 7 years. And the more of those doubling periods you have, the better. So even someone who saves a modest amount in their early years can end up with more than somebody that actually saves more later on. It's that power of compounding. So you want to get in that workplace 401k if you have access and steadily contribute to it. These things can add up over time more than you realize.
So whether you're taking a cruise on credit, stockpiling your 401k for a rainy day, thinking about buying or selling a house, loving the topsy-turvy world of ever-changing tariffs, or hating it, we've got you covered with the latest information here at On Deadline. I'm Lauren Barry, and I want to say thank you for listening. This show is produced by me and by Christy Strouser. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, my name is Lloyd Lockridge, and I'm the host of a new podcast from Odyssey called Family Lore. In this podcast, I'm going to have people on to tell unusual and sometimes far-fetched stories about their families.
I've heard my whole life that she invented the margarita.
And then we're going to investigate those stories and find out how much of it is true.
He gets a patent 1 month before the Wright brothers. Oh my God.
Please follow and listen to Family Lore, an Odyssey podcast, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.